Hello and welcome to The Epic Echo, a podcast created to reflect the voices of our community. This podcast is brought to you by the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center in West Virginia, and I'm your host, Nora Frazier. Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Epic Echo. Today I am joined by Anne Lewin, the Director of Social Equity, Inclusion, and Title IX at Shepherd University, responsible for coordinating efforts across campus to ensure equity in all university programs and activities, and university compliance with federal civil rights legislation. Ms. Lewin manages the prompt response and equitable resolution for complaints of discrimination and harassment, including sexual misconduct, to ensure a fair process for all parties, including addressing any hostile environment concerns and engaging in prevention education efforts to restore harm and prevent the potential for future harassment or violence. Ms. Lewin delivers campus-wide training and ongoing education to promote a campus culture based on mutual respect, dignity, and value for all, and conducts ongoing assessments of campus climate to identify systemic issues to guide the continuous review and revision of plans, policies, and practices that address discrimination, harassment, and violence. The focus of today's episode is what's known to college campuses and students as the red zone. The red zone is a time of statistically heightened instances of sexual assault that happens during the first semester of the year, the fall semester, and typically ranges from late August to November. There are a number of reasons that this time of year can be potentially more dangerous to certain populations within a college campus, which we'll get into in today's episode. I think it's pretty clear based on that bio that you are the perfect guest for this episode, Annie, not just because of your role at Shepherd, but because of your incredible expertise in all things campus, violence, harassment. I mean, you're pretty much the best expert I could think to find on this subject. So welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you want, you can take a sec to introduce yourself before I absolutely bombard you with questions.
Thanks for having me. I think that was a great introduction, so I don't think I really need to say any more other than Annie. Call me Annie.
Perfect. All righty. Well, as we are getting ready to have a brand new semester, which means a brand new oncoming of students and situations, and clearly things have changed a lot based on just what August looks like on campus from a couple of years ago to now with the pandemic that's happened and kind of changed the way things look at the beginning of the semester. But all of that being said, I want you to start by explaining the red zone in your own words, kind of, and the impact that you've seen it have on students in your time at the university. And however that's best for you, whether you want to do like a pre-COVID and a post-COVID, I'm not sure how much these answers will have changed for you in the past couple of years. So just kind of like, answer it however you feel best.
Okay, so the red zone is basically the time period right at the beginning of classes starting. So it's the first 6 to 9 weeks of classes. And it goes from, you know, like the end of August until around mid-November. And we see the highest risk for sexual violence during this period on college campuses across the country. And for me, it's always been a time that we have received increased reports, but we also know that the stats are high even outside of what's actually reported to us, because we did a climate survey a couple years ago right before COVID. And we found in the climate survey that we do have a pretty high red zone, and you see like a drastic increase and then that huge drop in November. In November, the weather cools, students are preparing for exams, they're getting ready to go back for, Thanksgiving break. And so you see like a big drop then. They're socializing less and all of that. And I would say that especially high risk periods and dates are homecoming weekend and also anytime around Halloween. If it falls on a weekend, it's even worse, but definitely Halloween. I haven't seen one year that I haven't had some kind of report around then.
And don't those usually fall pretty close together as far as dates go, homecoming and Halloween?
Yeah, they're both in October usually.
Weird.
And you know, like every year, like full transparency, I get really anxious around this time period, and Like I haven't slept well this week. I've been doing, you know, training with the football team every day this week because they're back. Some of those fall sports are back this week. And so I've done football and men's soccer. But for the football training, we've been doing like the returning students in small groups Monday and Tuesday. And then yesterday we did a smaller group of incoming students. And then today we'll do the second half of the incoming, but we have a big incoming class for football. So we have 50 new students. And then I'm also preparing for orientation training next week and some student leadership training, but I'm always, you know, trying to think, you know, meet the students where they're at and think really deeply about what they need to hear to prevent and to raise education and awareness, especially during this really, you know, high risk time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just a quick like Google search to kind of feel out where, you know, how people feel about the red zone or like what people know about the red zone kind of brought me back with the opinion that just I don't think a lot of people are even aware of it. And in a time when I feel like, you know, the high school straight to college pipeline is like really gushing right now, you know, like that's pretty normal to be expected of high school students to at least, you know, give it a shot. But, you know, for us kind of funneling them straight into college, I don't think that we're doing a great job at prepping them before they get there, which obviously puts a lot more pressure on the folks like you at the universities, because these are students who are experiencing brand new things and learning how to fill out loan paperwork and college classes. And then we're also expecting you all to kind of give them all of the information that they need on preventing sexual violence in this red zone period. So I do hope that eventually we see a little bit more like pre-college prep work and explaining what the red zone is and explaining how to keep yourself safe and how to keep your friends safe, how to have safe parties and things like that, which we're going to get into a lot today. But that being said, actually leads us right into our next question, which is that time frame of the red zone happens during the first semester of the year in the fall. And we don't really see statistically that happening again in the spring, which kind of the main difference, I guess, would be the large incoming of new students. So what is it about those new students that you think makes them more at risk? Or is it just that perfect storm of the weather and the timing and new to campus? Like, what do you think coincides with fall and these new students that kind of makes that period more dangerous than we see in the spring?
Well, I think a big piece of it is what you already said. Like, they're not, you know, no one's having conversations about consent and healthy boundaries and healthy relationships and communication prior to, you know, sometimes there's parents doing it. In some schools, you know, I've had students say, oh, you know, not West Virginia usually, but in other states that they, you know, they have had some conversations prior to coming, but a lot of students are coming and they're saying, I ask in a lot of the trainings, when's the first time you learned about consent? And I'll say, when I got to college. And that's just too late to have that conversation. So they're coming like unprepared with even understanding boundaries, right? You know, like we're not taught boundaries growing up. And in fact, we're like taught the opposite. And so I think that's a big piece of it. They don't have the knowledge and they haven't had the conversations to prepare them. And then, you know, they also don't have like a solid, you know, support group or friend group yet. So they're new and that increases vulnerabilities when you're out and about and you know, you don't have your people yet. The other thing is, you know, they're not only not learning about consent, they're, you know, a lot of times learning about sex through things like pornography. And like we know the average age that someone's seeing sexually explicit material online is like 8 years old. And so it's legitimately confusing for a lot of people what a healthy sexual intimate interaction looks like when all you've seen is, you know, what's in pornography, which is very, you know, distorted from what the reality is. And so I think that's a big piece of it. And just in the media in general. So if we're not having conversations about what healthy boundaries and consent look like, and you're learning about it in from, you know, unhealthy places, then it's going to be confusing for you. And then to top it all off, you're this new freedom, and then you maybe haven't had a lot of experience with alcohol or you know, other drugs. And so that can play a part in an already perfect storm of confusion and like lack of understanding. So I think that's a big piece. And then another piece is that on a lot of campuses, you see even the new students, they have kind of even less access to like spaces that they control or own, you know what I mean? And that's a lot that they talk about in the Sexual Citizens book that was written a couple years ago that I've used a lot recently to understand the issues of sexual violence on college campuses. And so giving those most vulnerable students spaces where they have power and control is really important for prevention.
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about specifically would be like, so a college dorm room, for any folks who are listening who may not know, typically when you're a freshman or like an incoming student for the first time, you're going to be in what's considered, I guess, like the newbie dorms, which aren't the, you know, the apartment setups with the living rooms and all of that stuff. It's going to be the more traditional dorms, which are going to have a bathroom down the hall, and the room might just be two shared beds and two desks. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of folks they don't really think about that being a factor in sexual harassment or sexual assault. But when you're an incoming student, and as you've just described perfectly, all those factors that add up to this perfect storm, I think what you're saying is then they go back to their dorm rooms to hang out with their new friends, and the only place that they really have to sit is on the bed, right? Mm-hmm. So there's not really a lot of space for them to take control over that situation, because where are they going to go? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then also that, you know, we have those requirements for, you know, younger students to be living on campus, and you see a lot of the parties are going to be these off-campus houses that are going to be older students having ownership and control over the space and the alcohol and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of these factors that I think we just kind of don't add them into this equation, but the more you, especially you, kind of really get to see all these factors come into play, I think it starts to make a lot more sense for folks. One of those other pieces that we haven't addressed yet is that the red zone also coincides with the period of the school year when Greek life organizations are returning to campus and they're having their rushing festivities and celebrations. And I just wondered how that influences behavior on campus during the red zone period.
Well, I think it goes back to what I said also, is that, yeah, you've got the older students having those socials or, you know, events, like at spaces that are, you know, owned and controlled by them. And they also control the alcohol and all of that. And so you've got, you know, younger students coming into those spaces, already vulnerable based on all the things that I listed. So I think that plays a role in there. And then it's not only the period when you have the fraternity and sorority life activities and, you know, the new rushing or whatever they call it. but you also have like the whole football season. It starts at the very beginning, you know, our first game's beginning of September, and then ends around November. Unless, you know, they go to the championships and all of that. But you see, you know, you see also every home game, you see a higher risk. And it's not a football team's fault or any, you know, athletics fault, but you just see more parties, you see just more consumption of alcohol, and all of our games are at noon. So
right.
People start drinking like really early that day and then continue and then, you know, go to parties after and all of that. So I think that plays a role also. All of those things going on and then all of the new students that haven't experienced any of that yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the time it's not necessarily, I don't think that I'm blaming anyone for this, because I myself have done this before as well. But I think that we like to focus on prevention sometimes, as new folks to prevention especially, as saying like, okay, how do you keep yourself safe in this situation? But I kind of want to take it a step further today. And because we know that there are going to be these student-led organizations that are going to be having parties and events and things like that. And there's not only not a way around that, but that's part of the college experience. We want them to create those senses of community in those spaces where they can just kind of build friendships and those relationships that are going to help them in the long run as prevention strategies, right? But how can those student-led organizations who are going to be hosting parties or events this fall, what advice can we give them to help them keep everyone safe so that we're not putting all of that responsibility on the individual college student? What can we look at as far as like those Greek life organizations or those people that are hosting those tailgates? How can we create the environment itself to be more safe so that we can put less of that responsibility on the individual student?
I do trainings with each athletics team, which I think helps because we have conversations about all of these things. And I also do fraternity sorority training, but that usually happens in the spring, which I've been trying to get it changed because it's just too late, you know? Obviously all the new students get the training, but I think the thing about boundaries and consent also is like, it's something you've got to practice. So we can tell, and they say this, and you know, they interviewed all of these college students in that book, Sexual Citizens, and they asked them, do you know what consent is? Affirmative consent, effective consent, and they could define it, but then they asked them about their sexual interactions and they weren't practicing it. So there's also a disconnect between being able to knowing, defining consent and practicing it. So we can teach them what it is, like it's, you know, it's ongoing, enthusiastic, active, mutual, you know, conversation and all of that. And, but then if they just learned it, they haven't had that time to practice it, especially when we don't, you know, talk about boundaries or practice that from a young age, which I think is something that could, you know, prevent if we had these conversations earlier, could prevent, because they would have that time to practice it. But they're learning it as soon as they get here. It's not going to just happen like that, you know? So I think that's a big piece. And then I also think, how cool would it be if like student organizations had like posters and things at the parties or their houses about consent? This is what consent is. If you're in trouble, like call this number or something, or like even like a QR code, or you know what I mean? Like, or if you need help, like, and then have like a designated person that could like be ready to like help out. And like somebody, if they are in a situation or they even see something and they don't necessarily feel comfortable saying something, they could text a number or something.
Like a DD, like a designated driver, except for someone who kind of stayed sober to make sure everybody stayed safe.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
And they had like little like koozies about like, so you were like, look down and you see like a message about consent, you know, like that would be cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's prevention, right? Having a designated driver is preventing driving drunk and preventing an accident because of that. So I think that if we just kind of were able to get past the barrier of folks being uncomfortable with talking about consent and all of those things, I think that it would be a lot simpler than some people think. Because you could have just that. You could have your designated consent warrior, or whatever you want to call them, who is available. I mean, I'm recently out of college for about a year and a half now. And I mean, those, you know, there's, everyone's going to have to go to the bathroom at the party. There's a space where you could, you know, put something up that says, if you need someone, here's someone that you can go to, and a phone number. So I think that it's a lot simpler than some people think, but you're not really thinking about that when you're in the moment, right? You're thinking about, oh, the party and what are we going to drink and who's going to get the booze and who's going to get the this. But I think that we just need to think about it as what it is. It's just a simple step to prevent a bad thing from happening, just like a DD. So I do think that that's really, really good advice. And I hope that there's some students listening who maybe think that that could be something they could do.
It's interesting that you use the designated driver analogy too, because it's, that's another kind of the thought that I had, you know, is that we don't just give our children the car keys and say, like, hope you don't get hurt, you know what I mean? Like when they're learning to drive. And you know, we have a whole like system set up that you take a class, you have to pass a test, all of these things, because it's dangerous. So why do we expect that they can just go into the environment? You know, like, we don't provide any kind of, you know, substance of consent education, boundary education, like, prior to, you know, releasing students into college.
Right. It's no wonder that students are uncomfortable talking about boundaries and consent when, up until they got to college, it appears to them that everyone else in their life was also uncomfortable talking about boundaries and consent, because no one's talking to them about it. So you're going to assume up until that point that if I haven't talked about it this far, it must not be any good to anybody else in my life, which are the people that you look up to and the people that have taught you everything you need to know about life and the world. So yeah, I think that makes perfect sense why students don't really grasp it the first time around. It might not even seem like something that they need to be concerned about if you're the first person they've ever met that's trying to tell them to prioritize it, which is why it's so important to start those conversations early. I mean, I have curriculum on this bookshelf right behind me that's telling us that we need to start as early as possible. If you're talking, we're talking about consent and boundaries, and kind of giving them that autonomy. So it is becoming more of the norm for parents, I think, to start having those conversations, but we also send them into school systems that need to, I think, carry their weight a little bit too. And there are some really, really great programs and some really great school systems that are trying very hard to implement this. We just need to make it bigger, right? So that one school that's doing amazing for their students is only producing a couple hundred students a year. I'm talking statewide, I'm talking nationally. So if you're listening to this and you are an educator or you do work for a school, consider that. There's some really great programs out there that can help us do it early, so that by the time we get to college, these conversations are normal. People feel very comfortable in their boundaries. I mean, that's another thing, is folks sometimes don't even know what their boundaries are. What am I comfortable with? Because they don't really think about it that way. If you like what you're hearing on the Epic Echo Media Musings, find us on social media at The Epic Echo. For episode reminders, updates, and to be involved in the conversation, find us on Facebook and Instagram. So we've kind of already talked about it a ton, but knowing what we already know about the red zone period, I want to talk a little bit about how you prepare the campus and the students for those months. So I know you've talked about training with athletes and Greek life organizations and orientations for students. What are some other ways that you kind of make your presence known on campus at this during this period?
All incoming students are required to complete the online Respect course, which we built using the Articulate software. And it's got videos of us, you know, campus voices, student voices, all of our policies and procedures. And, you know, it touches on a lot of different topics, including boundaries, consent, healthy relationships, bystander intervention, understanding power dynamics, language, Title IX, equity, diversity, inclusion, ethics, ally empowerment, empathy, and building resilience. So they're all required to complete that by the first week, by September 2nd is the due date, and they've all been sent it already, and they have access to it through their online Brightspace learning management system. So they'll have that, and then when they get here onto campus, we'll do an in-person orientation presentation where I will present, and Dr. Howard Bostic, the Associate Vice President for Diversity and Equity, and also Counseling Services. So we'll be talking about consent, diversity and equity, and, you know, wellness and mental health. So they'll get that also. And then, like I said, I do the, you know, training with all the athletics teams and fraternity and sorority life. And then sometimes we come into the FIACS courses and things like that, or we have some student leaders do that. And then we're also planning a week of sexual health and empowerment during the first full week of September, right after Labor Day, where we're going to have some student leaders tabling. We're going to have you all come in and tabling, and you're going to present a bystander intervention training. We're going to do a sexual health empowerment trivia night. We're going to also do a sexual health panel to have a conversation about all of these topics, and then end it with a documentary about like the sex education in the U.S. right now. So that'll be a really cool week to raise awareness and get student leaders involved. And then we continue to do programming and education throughout the year, and you know, also on social media and things like that. Especially we send out like emails and social media blasts and all that stuff right around like the first home game, homecoming, Halloween, trying to keep the consistent messaging out there. But it would be really great if student organizations and leaders would, you know, pull those and share them, and like we were just talking about at the houses and the parties, having the information up and available would be really, really neat, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I also want to commend you. I already knew about this event, of course, because we're going to be involved in it here at EPIC. But I just want to commend you for a second for taking the lens of, which is my favorite as a prevention educator, empowerment as prevention. I think a lot of universities and a lot of just folks in general still frame prevention around kind of like scare tactics almost. Like, we're going to tell you what is the worst possible thing imaginable that could happen to you, and then we're going to tell you how not to have that happen. But there's this whole other more positive side to prevention, which is empowerment, which is teaching folks how to set those boundaries, what those boundaries look like, what consent is, why they never were educated about sex, and then kind of picking up those pieces and educating them about sex and kind of just giving them the knowledge and then sending them out. And that is prevention. And I think that that's a really great lens of prevention that a lot of people overlook.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, finding your voice is huge, and that's, you know, empowerment and knowing that your voice has value and that you deserve respect, and we all deserve our boundaries to be respected, and we deserve to be heard and listened to.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited to be a part of that week. I know EPIC is as well. I just had to take a pause and talk about how great that work actually is through a prevention lens. So now getting into, let's just keep on trucking. So what can communities, parents, or friends of students do to help them prepare and cope with the heightened risk of sexual assault as they come to campus in the fall? We've talked a little bit about like having those conversations early on. But you know, I'm kind of this specific question thinking more along the lines of, we're here, right? We're in August. What can we do in these last couple of weeks to kind of help students just feel comfortable and prepared to get onto campus and enter this red zone period?
I think knowing all the resources, making sure that students are, you know, like we've already said, having these conversations and all of that, and parents are having the conversations also, but you know, taking the time to think like about, you know, what they want out of interactions and intimacy when they get to campus, and being able to communicate that clearly prior to and you know, and that's why it goes back to like the practicing thing. So like knowing like what do I want, and being able to communicate that beforehand. And obviously, you know, anyone can change their mind in the moment, but like I think just knowing, just like even when we talk about bystander intervention, like knowing ahead of time, what will I do in that situation? Will I be more comfortable directing, distracting, delegating, whatever, you know what I mean? So like even thinking about that with like interactions, physical intimacy, boundaries, all those things, like what am I comfortable with, what do I like, and like and knowing that ahead of time and thinking about that ahead of time, I think is important. And maybe talking to, you know, people that you trust ahead of time about those things, having those open conversations that like everyone's afraid to talk about, because I just think it makes such a difference being able to practice that. And I'm getting lost now. What can everybody do right now as we're already here, kind of?
Yeah,
and
everyone
just,
but
I
the
think
students themselves. What can the people around the students themselves
community
do?
I think, you know, having the resources available and out there, and so that, you know, everyone knows where they can go, so educating that way.
Yeah, like a little bit of safety planning, even almost. That's something that we do a lot, especially with our clients, of course. But, you know, here's who you can go. Here's the numbers. We'll make sure that you have the numbers already accessible to you or in your phone, just in case you need them for Campus PD or the Title IX office or even Epic. And just making sure that you're kind of doing everything you can ahead of time so that if something does happen, you're prepared, right?
Yeah, and also trusting your gut. Like, if you feel like something's weird or unsafe, like, just going with it and getting out of there, away from there. But then, you know, if in the case that you're still in this situation, having, you know, resources available that you can call with your phone and all of those things readily available is
Yeah,
a good
that's
idea.
great. And I also want to throw in, of course, this is no secret. This is one of my favorite types of prevention, which is bystander intervention. Also, I think that's a great time in these last couple of weeks. I mean, you're packing up dorm room stuff and making a million runs to Target to get extension cords and all that stuff. And on one of those drives to and from the store, even if you just take that 5 minutes to talk about bystander intervention, and kind of what that means, what that looks like, how would you intervene? What would you feel comfortable doing? Because, I mean, we obviously are going to do that once they get to campus, but hearing it from someone that you have that trust and connection with is going to mean a lot more than you or I can do in the training sessions that we give, although we sure try.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for parents also having like a knowing, sharing with their students like other options for connection and resources, because that's the last person sometimes they want to talk to if something happens. So, and maybe they don't want to talk to me, but like talking through like, these are all the different people you can talk to. If you don't feel comfortable talking to this person, these are all the options, just knowing all of them so you don't feel alone.
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, you probably could have guessed what's coming next. What would you say the most important thing for students to know as we get ready to enter the red zone? And this could be returning students or new students, whichever you choose to answer. But clearly, we've already talked about how we're not trying to just use these scare tactics on them. So what can they be doing on their own if they maybe don't have those people in their lives who are going to help them have those conversations or, you know, what have you? What can they be doing?
I mean, there's so many resources out there too, to like just learn about your body, learn about, you know, what you like, what you don't like, and know that it's, you know, it's okay to engage in, you know, sexual interactions. It's okay for everyone to enjoy and to find pleasure. And so, you know, I think learning about yourself and what you like and don't like in so many ways, not just sexually, but like, I mean, that's kind of what college is about too. It's like, you're evolving, the transformation. And so just getting that started and being comfortable with the journey, and learning. We all have so much to learn. And I mean, like, I think that is a big piece of it, you know, learning about yourself, and then you can have the self-awareness to engage with others, and openly communicate and have dialogue. And then, you know, also like checking in, creating a space where other people feel comfortable communicating with you. So a lot of reason that, you know, a lot of barriers to expressing and communicating boundaries are like this fear of like, what's the other person going to do or say? So like, we can create like comfortable spaces where like, hey, I want you to talk to me and tell me about you and what you like, what you don't like, and all of these things. And like, and then also like the actively listening to all of that. So just, I mean, honestly, like practicing communication. I mean, because we're all, I mean, like everyone's looking at their phones. We're all struggling with communication. So getting away, getting out of social media and just starting to engage with the human connection, I think is a big piece that we can all do. And that I think we're all kind of craving, but doing it in a way that we're prepared to have healthy relationships and interactions.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that there's a lot that you can do even internally without the help of anybody else that can really prepare you for those situations. Just like you said, assessing what you're comfortable with and knowing that before you get to campus and before you go into these situations, if you know 100% what you're comfortable with, it's going to be easier to communicate it. Even if you still are uncomfortable with the communication piece, just having that knowledge of I'm not going to go past this point because I'm uncomfortable, even that alone is going to make it easier, because you go in knowing and you're not there in the moment thinking, oh, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't. If you have that firm boundary in your head, it's going to be easier to communicate it. And then obviously we hope that you'll think about the qualities that you want to see in a partner, whether that just be sexual or romantic, and make sure that you're looking for someone who is capable of communicating and is capable of understanding your boundaries and respecting them, of course. So I think that was a great answer. And then you kind of touched on it actually a little bit already. But obviously we did in the beginning address that the red zone period is both reflected in the reports that you receive, but also in those climate surveys that you've done in the past. And those numbers don't always tend to match up. And that's not just Shepherd, that's every university. But that means essentially that there are some barriers that students are facing when it comes to reporting sexual assault. And I wondered if you would help us understand how we as a community can help remove those barriers so that students are aware and comfortable with the process of reporting. Because clearly students are aware that you're there on campus and you're doing a lot to engage with them. But maybe there's some other piece that we're missing that we could do as a community to help students be more comfortable and kind of take those barriers down.
I mean, I think that one big barrier is just like not knowing like what's going to happen, but understanding that it's not like a, you know, runaway train, that like there are lots of different options, that, you know, there's informal options, there's formal options. And we'll work together to come up with a plan that's going to be the most supportive and comfortable for the individual that's experienced the harassment or violence, and ensuring that they have continued access to education and all the resources that are available, you know. And then we also have the mechanisms in place of reporting. So, you know, all employees are responsible employees and they have to report if they have any knowledge of sexual misconduct. But like reframing that too, which we've done a lot of, is, you know, it's not like I have to go tell someone, I have to go report this, but like, I'm going to connect you to a whole team of campus and community resources that want to make sure that you are safe and that you have continued access to all the programs and activities to get your education and to be continuously successful. So I think that's an important piece that we can reframe and kind of get down, like remove that barrier. I think another big barrier, which they talk about in the Sexual Citizens book also, is like, especially on a small campus, it's, and this goes along with the fear of like the retaliation for, you know, if you report, like what is the other person going to do? Or, but also like, it might disrupt your safety network. It might disrupt your friend group. And like for some people, it is more important to maintain the peace of that than to report and to, you know, to go through. I mean, again, like a lot of people don't know that there's lots of different options and things, but that is like a huge piece, I think. And to overcome that, I mean, I think understanding that It might be okay to disrupt that. Maybe that's not the best thing for you. Maybe those people aren't the best thing for you. And maybe that's the journey to find, you know, more positive people in your life. But that's hard. I think that's a really hard one, because that can really interrupt your existence as a student is the disruption of a solid friend cohort, you know, that like, if it's like a mutual friend and that disrupts all of that, and it's like, who do we believe and all of the you know, the issues that arise from that. So I think that's a tough one. But also being aware of all the different other, you know, options for student engagement on campus and different organizations. And, you know, I think that's an issue that probably comes up for fraternities and sororities too, because I mean, it has come up for those groups, but anybody really, you know, because a lot of times, and we know it's over 95% of the incidents are occurring between, you know, individuals that know each other or are acquaintances. And so a small school, especially, you've got mutual friends, you might even be close friends. So that's a difficult one.
Yeah, and I think as a community, although this is a very difficult one for the individual and for the community, I think, but I think as a community, one thing that could be done to help students on campus as a campus community, and then as a community as a whole, is just trying to prevent those silos from happening, where you have only friends that are within this organization or only friends that are within this group of 10 people. I think if the campus community just kind of grew slightly, not even in number, but just in connection, that would be just slightly easier. And the way that that's going to happen is just by engaging more with your peers that live or go to school on the campus with you, just trying to make sure that you're not putting yourself in the situation to where the only people you communicate with are these 10 people within this group. And that's not just to prevent yourself from being victimized. That's also to prevent folks in your group from being uncomfortable, because I think this goes even further than just sexual assault or harassment, but I mean, even just racial bias or anything like that that can happen within those groups, it's going to cause tension, like you said, and folks are still going to be afraid to discuss that because of the retaliation that could happen. So I think if we just kind of try to enrich those relationships and those connections on campus and make it kind of more of a web than like a tree, or however you want to describe it. I think that could be one way that the campus community could try to help.
Yeah, and I mean, we've all been, you know, there's been a lack of engagement because of COVID. So I think people are feeling particularly isolated and have been. And so it's very important for them to maintain those connections. So I think you're right, you know, having more engagement is going to be helpful in, you know, different areas where you can find connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that EPIC and Title IX will be trying our best to provide some of those opportunities to have some of those engagement opportunities and some great conversations. As you said, with the Sexual Empowerment Week, and EPIC will be there tabling and doing, you know, all kinds of stuff that we do in the fall just to kind of help bridge those gaps and make those connections for the students on campus. I don't have any more questions for you today, but I did want to offer you some time here at the end of the podcast to talk about any of the Title IX services that you think folks are unfamiliar with or that could be beneficial. You can take this time, or we can just kind of like summarize it briefly and then wrap up. But I wanted to offer you the time to list and explain any services that you think may be confusing or that just might benefit folks that may not know about them.
So, you know, we do a lot of prevention education. So, you know, any student organization could, you know, request some training or, you know, conversations. We're happy to help in that way. And the other piece is the, you know, response to any type of harassment, discrimination, or violence. And whenever we, you know, receive a report, we reach out and try to connect the individual with all the different resources on campus and off campus. And like I said before, you know, we can do an informal process that, you know, can be tailored to the specific situation. We can include no contact orders. We can move residence hall rooms around. We can move classes around. We can switch, you know, job assignments and things like that to ensure that, you know, we're getting rid of any kind of hostile environment concerns without, you know, doing a formal process or anything like that. But we also have the formal resolution process where we do a formal investigation, and that goes to a formal hearing board, and they determine if a policy has been violated, and then if the respondent is found responsible, they issue sanctions that could, you know, range from probation, education, to expulsion. And then, you know, as far as the informal resolution goes, it can, you know, be an agreement with certain elements, like, you know, no contact, education, community restorations, or we can also do restorative processes, restorative justice. And so I think that's another kind of option that requires accountability, but moving forward can, you know, restore the harm to the individuals and to the community, because, you know, anytime the community also is harmed, and we lose trust and all those things anytime an incident of violence or harassment occurs. And so that's also an option, and that could be a helpful option too in a circumstance where you have like a friend group that's been disrupted. Could that be resolved in a restorative process? That's something that's an option also. So those are some of the different, you know, options. And we also obviously connect with you all and other resources, and counseling is a great service that we have here, and you all provide also. And so I think that's some information that could be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure most folks that need this information already know it, but I will just go ahead and plug it for you. All of the information about Title IX and your whole department and every service that you provide is on Shepherd's website, correct?
Right.
That's what I figured. I just wanted to go ahead and share that as well. So you can visit Shepherd's website if you have any more questions about that. All of Annie's contact information will be there, as well as like a much more detailed description of what services Title IX provides and how to get in contact with those folks. So just a short plug of that for anyone who may need it. And then I'm going to take just a few seconds to kind of wrap up what we've talked about here today, because we have covered so much great stuff, and I want to make sure folks leave the episode as soon as they turn their phones off, they're still thinking about it. So to ease Annie's anxiety, and to most importantly keep the students on campus safe, we as communities are going to need to start having conversations about boundaries and consent a lot earlier than we are right now. Obviously, that doesn't go for everyone, but as a majority, we need to make those conversations the norm. We need to start empowering our students before they get to college campuses to know themselves, to know their bodies, to know what they're comfortable with, so that they can have those boundaries established and keep themselves safer. We need to talk about sex. A lot of folks don't love to talk about sex, whether that be, you know, within your families or within your schools. I am a personal huge fan of talking about sex. I think it's so, so important, and it could solve a lot of the issues that we face, not just on college campuses, but in communities as a whole, if we just kind of tore down that wall and built some transparency. So you need to start having those conversations. They truly are important in keeping ourselves safe and in keeping the folks that we love safe. And we want to know what resources are available before you get to campus. All those resources are going to be shared with your students when they get to campus, but so are the resources for where to eat and where to go to the bathroom and where to sleep and how to get to class and who has office hours. And so they're really, really overwhelmed by the time they get there. But if they have those resources in their back pocket before they get to campus and are overwhelmed, I think that's a great way to help them out as well. And Annie, feel free to jump in if I missed any huge points. And if not, then I want to thank you so much for being here with me today and sharing all this great info.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. And I wish you all the luck with your upcoming events and with the students coming onto campus. I hope that it's a really great semester for everyone and that we can all play our part in helping to make it safe.
Thanks, Nora.
Absolutely. Have a great rest of your day. And thanks for listening, everyone. We at The Echo want your input. Find us on social media to help us choose topics for our conversations and to ask us questions that you'd like us to answer on air. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at The Epic Echo.